Contrary to the popular saying, war is man's oldest profession. It's interesting that in all of the ancient pantheons, there was a god of war, a Mars. And even more interesting in the fact that this god of war was not described as a devil god, red of tooth and claw, but he was seen rather as a protector deity, testimony to the fear all peoples felt against against their enemies. Those who claim to be realists describe war as statecraft pursued by other means, which I take it to mean that war is simply the way in which tribes or countries carry out their communal greed and work out their communal aggressions. It's interesting that, as far as we know, every family, tribe, or society which has lived close to another family, tribe, or society has devised some means of defense, some means to protect their possessions and their persons. And if we reverse this, it means simply that every family, tribe, or society which has ever lived has felt not only threatened, but has felt the desire at times to reach out, to take what does not belong to it. And almost always it has justified this kind of action as a necessary defense, winning security for itself, as finding Lebensraum, finding room for its people to live with some measure of decency. And perhaps the saddest fact of all is that most wars have been fought by most people under the illusion that war is the way to peace, and that this war, the last war, will be the war that will end the necessity forever of another war. Now, traditionally, Judaism has not blinked away the necessity for self-defense. We are not a pacifist tradition. You read the Bible, you recognize that both ancient Israel and ancient Judah maintained standing armies. And when you read in the Torah, you discover that God himself led out the hosts of Israel, the army of Israel, against those peoples who barred the ways of the Israelites under Moses as they went through the desert, who attacked the Israelites during the wilderness trek. But the Bible and the Jewish tradition looks upon wars as sometimes an unfortunate necessity, but it never glorifies power or an army, or military might, as a proof of the nation's glory. Indeed, I could put together a thick anthology of the statements, the thoughts of the Bible, of the rabbis, of the Talmud, of all of our literature, having to do with peace and the urgency of peace, the necessity of being a peacemaker. Shalom. Let the way of the righteous be the making of peace. How beautiful upon the mountaintops are the footsteps of the messenger of good tidings, who brings the message of peace. And as we read in the sayings of the fathers from the mission this morning, seek peace and pursue it. To which later commentators added, seek peace in your own place and pursue peace in the place of others. And for the last 2,000 years at least, the petitional prayers of our worship, the Amidah, have ended with that great prayer, Sim Shalom, grant us peace, thy most precious gift, O thou eternal source of peace, and enable Israel to be a messenger of peace unto the nations of the world. The need for peace is heartfelt. Its achievement, of course, unfortunately, elusive. And when you think of all the brain power which man has brought to bear over the long centuries and all the problems which confront society, there's nothing more tragic than to recognize in the sum and substance of human wisdom in the area of peace making is deterrence. To build the strongest castle possible, to put one scientist at work building new weapons technology, to create for yourself a situation in which you can punish an aggressor more seriously than he can punish you, or at least sufficiently so that he has nothing to gain from attack. Somehow, despite all the great minds that have ever existed, mankind has not moved beyond the most primitive conditions, the same essential situation which the caveman knew, that if he was to protect his cave, his home, he needed some weapons at hand to drive off the aggressor, and that those weapons and the numbers that he had in his cave to protect him ought to be sufficient to inflict heavy damage upon the predator, that unless he was able to do so, there would be no security and no peace for him. But if history teaches us anything, it is that this policy is feckless. There is always someone who believes that the most impregnable castle can be stormed, that the most complicated weapons system can be reduced to the point where it can be attacked and overrun and overwhelmed, that there is no defense, no military defense, no electronic defense, which cannot be surmounted and which cannot be turned against those who are using it. And so mankind has always lived under the threat of war, the shadow of attack. Perhaps psychologists will explain to us why there are times when we feel less burdened by this danger and other times when we feel the danger to be more immediate. There's a kind of undulation in our emotional reaction to the truth of all political situations, that they are tense and potentially dangerous. Certainly during part of the post-war period, we have lived with nuclear deterrence without too much real anxiety about it, and there are times such as now when anxiety seems to be mounting, when the nuclear freeze movement is a clear indication that there is a growth of visible concern, of immediate concern, about what has been a fact of life, really, since the end of the Second World War. Now, one can explain this peaking of concern because of the sudden recognition that the Soviet Union has, for the last several decades, been pouring its wealth into a massive program of military buildup, and by the determination of the present administration in Washington to play a game of military catch-up, to pour billions of dollars into our own military deterrence. But in the end, all of us recognize that the building up of an army only leads the enemy, the other, to build up his army, and that ultimately, all arms races have ended in war. All peace gained only through means of deterrence has ended in conflict. And so we look around rather desperately for some means to resolve the tensions, to reduce the danger. And the nuclear freeze movement suggests that most Americans, at least most Europeans, have find some hope in negotiation, in strategic arms limitation treaties, in the reduction of the numbers of weapons in the hands of the various nations. I must confess that I set little store by the hope of these negotiations. People negotiate contracts all the time. And when they do, and when businesses negotiate contracts, they do so out of careful calculation. And if one party or the other to the contract decides to renege, that it is no longer in his benefit to carry out its terms, there is a court to which one can turn. There is a superior force which will enforce the terms of the contract which has been agreed upon. But when the cold-eyed statesmen of the world calculate their national advantage, and even if they find that it is to their national advantage to enter into some kind of armed limitations agreement, if one or the other side wants to find a way to get around it, not to live up to its spirit, much less to the letter of the law, there is no court on earth which can enforce that contract. And as a matter of fact, most of the arms limitation treaties which have been negotiated, certainly in this century, have been negotiated and have ended, as had the first SALT treaty and the second SALT treaty, with more missiles at the ready, greater nuclear power ready in the hands of the Soviet Union and the United States than at the year when the treaty was negotiated. We limited certain kinds of arms, not other kinds of arms. There's always a way around, a way to build up one's strength despite. Those of you who remember the naval treaties which were negotiated at the end of the First World War, recall an attempt to reduce the dreaded size, the dreaded power of the battleship, what was called then the dreadnought. The major naval countries negotiated a series of treaties which limited the number and the size of battleships that could be built. And the Western allies, who by this time were tired of war, looked upon these treaties as a way of not spending the money on defense which might have been necessary, while Germany and Japan looked upon these treaties simply as a means of gaining advantage on the West. And they built a series of what were called pocket battleships, which were just a foot short of the size stipulated in the contract and had, in fact, greater firepower than any of the battleships which were included in the various treaties. Unfortunately, given the mutual distrust which exists between East and West, between all countries of the earth, it is unlikely that a treaty of any kind would end in anything better than all of the generals and all of the military-industrial complex of that society, of each society, looking around quickly to find ways to increase its firepower without directly violating the terms of the contract which has been agreed on. And if one wants to wax romantic about the desire of the world to reduce armaments, we have only to look at a much simpler problem, a domestic problem, the attempts which have been going on now for a long time in our country to disarm our population, to take away the revolvers and the guns which worry us on the street, and to recognize that we have been totally unsuccessful even in that limited objective, and that at the end of every single year in the 20th century, there have been more guns in the hands of more Americans than when that year began. And so it's not to be a matter of some surprise that we look around for other ways to deal with the question of life and death on Earth, the question of war and peace, and that many are tempted to look towards more radical programs. Will, in fact, a program of active nonviolence be effective? Is that the answer? Is the example that Mohandas Gandhi set for us in the first part of the century an answer which may, in fact, have value for us? Are we going about the problems of negotiation, of arms reduction, the right way? Or should we, like Gandhi, simply bare our breasts, give up any thought of armament, and try by personal example to deflect the world from aggression and to suggest to the world the way of peace? Now, Gandhi was among the most heroic and noble of the figures which this century has produced. He's seen by many, he certainly was seen in the recent film, as the founder of modern India, the creator of Indian independence. I doubt if we can give him that accolade, because Indian independence would have come in this century regardless of Gandhi's presence or absence. By the 20th century, colonialism had simply become too expensive for the European countries to maintain this policy. And so we've seen throughout the Third World independence come into being by force or by satyagraha, active nonviolence, the policy that Gandhi promoted in India. The Third World populations were growing apace. They were increasingly restive. Their economic value to the West had diminished. It was increasingly costly to maintain law and order domination. And so Africa, Asia, and Southeast Asia throughout this century have moved towards independence. But there are many ways in which independence could be achieved. by open warfare, as in Algeria, by negotiations, as in India or Zimbabwe, Palestine. But in the process of gaining independence for India, Gandhi was able, through his person and through his philosophy, to enunciate a policy which has appealed to many, which certainly has the force of moral grandeur and honesty about it, and one which we ought to investigate to see what its possibilities are. Because there are those among us who are convinced that in some form, whether it be the Christian turning the other cheek, or Gandhi's ahimsa, the concept, the Hindu concept of love, which is that one must act in such a way that one's enemy is turned into a friend, is made to recognize the justice of one's way. Whatever policy we adopt among all of these rather pacifistic traditions, perhaps this is the way for the West, for the world, to go. Now, the attractiveness of Gandhi lay in his integrity. He was a man who gained great power, but unlike almost any other leader of our century, he did not use this power for his own benefit. Where others lived in palaces, he lived in a simple hut in his ashram, a rural village. Where others drove around in great, wide limousines, he traveled through India on third-class coaches, or he walked with his staff across the Indian countryside. Where others dressed well and dressed their wives even more in more costly raiment, as a leader, Gandhi dressed in a simple loincloth and asked nothing for his family. He was a man whose austerity of life was compelling. He came to be seen as the Mahatma, the great soul, the conscience of India. And he spoke to Indian evils as well as to those of England. He was the great defender of the Harijan, of the outcasts, of that class of the Indian population which for the millennia had been reduced not only to poverty, but to being unseen, unnoticed, had been reduced really to the status of being non-human. He insisted on their humanity, insisted on their being brought into his ashram and given equal place there with the Brahmin, the well-born, and the wealthy. And he used his great power not only to free India of the British, but to remind the merchant princes of India that they must treat their workers decently and pay them a decent wage. He saw evil wherever it existed, and he tried to combat evil by making the people who were committing it understand the violence that they were doing, understand the evil of their actions, and want themselves to correct what had been before. Now, Satyagraha, this great doctrine of Gandhi, is essentially the doctrine that I will not return evil for good. I will not add to the violence of the world. What I will do is when I need to disobey unjust laws, but I will not deny my disobedience. I will accept whatever suffering, whatever prison sentence my obedience might require at the before the court of law. I will try through my suffering and through my patience and through my example to make the oppressor, to make those who sit in judgment enforcing evil laws recognize the falsity, the wrongness of their acts, in a sense to come to the recognition that they on their own should correct the situation. Because they are violent men, I will not respond with violence. It's a great doctrine. It doesn't work. In 1946, about a year or so after the United States had exploded the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and so brought the Japanese war to a quick end, the photographer Margaret Brooke White, who met often with Gandhi in his latter years, asked him this question. What would you do, Gandhi, if the Enola Gay, the plane carrying the atomic bomb, were flying overhead? How would you affect by satyagraha, by ahimsa, these doctrines of yours, that pilot? And Gandhi answered, I would not go underground. I would come out in the open and let the pilot see I have not a trace of ill will against him. The pilot will not see our faces from his great height, I know. But the longing in our hearts, the will that he not come to harm, would reach up to him and his eyes would be open. Now, there's a certain bravery in that response, and no one ever questioned Gandhi's bravery and courage. But there's a certain incredibility to the response. For in the cocoon of the airplane, surrounded by the noise of the motors, miles above the earth, the pilot would hardly see even a Gandhi standing silently praying for the well-being of his soul. Unfortunately, modern warfare is no longer face-to-face. Our technical proficiency has given to modern warfare an anonymity. The destroyer no longer sees the person he destroys. And if the pilot of a plane is several miles above the earth and no longer sees the man on earth, in the next 30 years we have come to the position where we are not only several miles away from those we would destroy, but thousands of miles away. Those who have control of the buttons, which will ultimately determine whether there is a missile attack on the Soviet Union or from the Soviet Union on the United States, are thousands of miles away from their targets in dark rooms under mountains, protected against atomic blast, in rooms surrounded by electronic equipment which map out for them, trace for them, the projectiles which are in the air. And the calculations which they make have nothing to do with the fact that a child is in Moscow or in Washington will be killed, or that Gandhi is in one of these capitals, but rather that if they launch a preventive attack, the attack which will inevitably come in return, we may only suffer 20 million casualties as opposed to 50 million casualties if we endure the first attack. In the conditions which we have created, the inhuman conditions which our technology has brought into being, the idea of the example, the courage of a single human being, or even a community of saintly men and women of saintly courage, is no longer compelling simply because it will no longer be seen. The Jewish philosopher Martin Buber developed at about the same time that Gandhi was alive some of the explanation in his work of what Gandhi was really achieving. Buber in 1921 published a little book which was called I and Thou, which has become one of the most popular books of religion and philosophy of the 20th century. And in that little volume, Buber spoke of the relationships which we have with others. He said there are essentially two kinds of relationships. There's what he called an I-it relationship. And that is a relationship where I am with others and thinking only of their usefulness to me. When I go to a store, I'm not thinking of the personality of the person there, but he's a clerk waiting on me. At a restaurant, whoever is serving is simply the waiter waiting on me. In a class, if I'm lecturing to 200 people, I'm really not thinking of them as individuals, but I'm thinking of my lecture. They are simply the audience, impersonal to me. Most of our relationships, Buber said, are these I-it relationships, where people are really simply objects, necessary objects in our lives. But there is another kind of relationship. He called this an I-you, or an I-thou relationship. It's a relationship of openness, where suddenly my personality and my needs and your personality and your needs, my anxieties and my hopes, your anxieties and your hopes, my experience and your experience are openly exchanged. There is a true openness in our relationship. Friendship, love, intimacy, learning, he said, comes in this way. And when there is this kind of flow of personality, flow of ideas, flow of empathy back and forth, relationships do change us. And when Gandhi stood up in that court in India, and said, yes, I have broken the laws of sedition, and yes, I am prepared to accept whatever punishment that you are to mete out to me. The judge who was sitting there in judgment carried out the law, but he was changed by the example of Gandhi. He no longer had that ultimate confidence in the rightness of law, all laws that he'd had before. He'd become a different human being. Now, Gandhi lived at a time when, for the first time in human history, our world had shrunk because of the marvels of modern communication. And I mean no disrespect to Gandhi, nor to suggest in any way that he was a poseur. To suggest that he was one of the first great leaders of our time to recognize the revolution in communications and what it meant for policy. He lived in the era of the camera, of the telegraph. If he had lived 100 years before, and he had taken that long march from his ashram to the coast to make salt there against the British monopoly on salt, somebody might have written two lines that a certain Indian holy man had taken a walk to the sea, and that might have been published in English in the London Times 6 weeks later and made very little impression. But all along the way, there were reporters and cameramen. And his way to the sea was reported every day in the press of the West. And there was in the West a population ready, willing, sensitive, concerned about the evils that Gandhi was trying to lift up and to make real, make to the world. And they responded. They were stimulated by this daily stream of news of his actions. There was an immediacy to his example, so that he created through his life an I-you relationship with the English, with many in England, who were already sympathetic and already prepared to recognize that the value of the Raj really had diminished for the British Empire. In fact, the whole concept of empire was out of place in the 20th century. Now, Martin Buber explains in this I-it-I-you structure something of the power of a person like Gandhi. He was able not only to affect those with whom he came in immediate contact, but through communication to affect those who were instinctively sympathetic to him outside of his world, who knew him only by reputation. But what of those with whom we cannot have anything but an I-it contact? The pilot in the plane, the man in the command center in the mountain who controls the missiles. I'm afraid that at that level, Gandhi's satyagraha, his concept of active nonviolence, is not the answer to our problem. And interestingly, in November of 1938, correspondence developed between Gandhi and Martin Buber. On the 26th of November 1938, in the paper which he called the Harijan, the Outcast, Gandhi published an article in which he raised two questions. The question of Jewish settlement in Palestine and the question of the German treatment of the Jews. Gandhi, in raising these questions, says that he has been asked a number of times about them. He finds them very difficult to answer. He says that in many ways the Jews are the Harijans of Christianity, by which he means that Christianity, religion, has devised a religious basis for declaring a group to be pariahs, just as in India, Hinduism had done this for the outclass, the untouchables. And then he goes on, and I'd like to read to you several paragraphs of the article that he wrote. My sympathies are all with the Jews. I have known them intimately in South Africa. Some of them became lifelong companions. Though through these friends, I came to learn much of their age-long persecution. They have been the untouchables of Christianity. The parallel between their treatment by Christians and the treatment of untouchables by Hindus is very close. Religious sanctions have been invoked in both cases for the justification of the inhuman treatment meted out to them. But my sympathy does not blind me to the requirements of justice. The cry for a national home for the Jews does not make much appeal to me. Why should they not, like other peoples of the earth, make that country their home where they are born and where they earn their livelihood? Of course, the nobler course would be to insist on a just treatment of the Jews wherever they are born and bred. The Jews born in France are French in precisely the same sense that Christians born in France are French. If Jews have no home but Palestine, will they relish the idea of being forced to leave the other parts of the world in which they are settled? But the German persecution of the Jews seems to have no parallel in history. Germany is showing to the world how efficiently violence can be worked when it is not hampered by any hypocrisy or weakness masquerading as humanitarianism. It is also showing how hideous, terrible, and terrifying it looks in its nakedness. Can the Jews resist this organized and shameless persecution? Is there a way to preserve their self-respect and not to feel helpless, neglected, and forlorn? I submit there is. If I were a Jew and were born in Germany and earned my livelihood there, I would claim Germany as my home, and even as the tallest Gentile German might, and challenge him to shoot me or cast me in the dungeon. I would refuse to be expelled or to submit to discriminating treatment. And for doing this, I should not wait for the fellow Jews to join me in civil resistance, but would have confidence that in the end, the rest were bound to follow my example. If one Jew or all the Jews were to accept the prescription here offered, he or they cannot be worse off than now. And suffering voluntarily undergone will bring them an inner strength and joy which no number of resolutions of sympathy passed in the world outside Germany can. I am convinced that if someone with courage and vision can arise among them to lead them in nonviolent action, the winter of their despair can, in the twinkling of an eye, be turned into the summer of hope. And what has today become a degrading manhunt can be turned into a calm and determined stand offered by unarmed men and women possessing the strength of suffering given to them by Jehovah. It will then be a truly religious resistance offered against the godless fury of dehumanized man. The German Jews will score a lasting victory over the German Gentiles in the sense that they will have converted the latter to an appreciation of human dignity. They will have rendered service to fellow Germans and proved their title to be the real Germans, as against those who are today dragging, however unknowingly, the German name in the mire. Now, this is November of 1938. The Nuremberg laws had been passed. The Jew badge was required dress. Kristallnacht, the burning of the synagogues, had taken place. The concentration camps were open, though not yet the death camps. Murder was openly tolerated and intimidation against the Jew. Martin Buber, in his response, tried to point out to Gandhi the difference between Germany in the 1930s and South Africa in the 1900s and India in the 1920s and 30s. He made the point that what Gandhi's prescription, because he also opposed the settlement of the Jews in Palestine, was really a prescription for mass suicide. And he said, in effect, Jews are taught by their scripture that we are not to commit suicide. God gave us the Torah to live by it, not to die for it. Martyrdom is not the ultimate end. But he said martyrdom might be an acceptable solution if, in fact, it had any chance of success. In India, in South Africa, the British had a sense of law and unjust laws, but there was also the common law. And the courts and the people were not at one in agreement that the Indian was a subhuman species, an it, who could be treated the same way one treats an animal, cattle, butchered at will. Gandhi, he said, had very little sense of the blindness that ideology and fanaticism and religion can create in the human heart. Gandhi, you recall, was raised in a rather unique environment. His father had been prime minister in a small northwestern Indian community where the dominant faith was an unusual one. He worshipped and was raised in a Shinto tradition where the shrine was completely Shinto in form but had no idols, no icons, and where the Quran, this holy scripture of Islam, was read as along with the Vedas, the Hindu scripture. The population of this small principality was about equally divided between Hindus and Muslims, and the tradition, the shrine was one which attempted to bind these traditions together. And there is no doubt in anyone's mind that in Gandhi's mind, the great religious traditions of the world, Christianity, Judaism, Islam, Hinduism, all of them could be bound together by certain common ethical and moral and spiritual concerns. He had no patience with those ideas and those values which divided. And therefore, he had little understanding of those men and those countries which are blinded by their truth, and whose truth includes the fact that another part of humanity are declared to be subhuman, parasites, and worse. Gandhi always thought of Hitler as a well-intentioned but misguided human being. He thought of him in much the same way as he thought of some of the high commissioners who had come out to rule in India. That ultimately, if you could stand before Hitler and stand up for your rights calmly and state your needs forthrightly, you would be able to change the Nazi mind. And Buber tried to point out to Gandhi as best he could that the situations in Germany and in India were not analogous, that the British, how much evil their traditions had caused and how much harm and hurt they had caused to the Indians, had not attempted to totally dehumanize India. Quite the contrary, they tried to educate the Indians and brought hospitals and brought all kinds of modern advantages to India. Hitler had only one purpose: to destroy the Jewish community, to drive it out of Europe, to purify Europe, to Aryanize Germany so that the Jew would no longer be a factor. This was an understanding that Gandhi never developed. He had no sense of the ability of people to be blinded to the point where they can never see another person as anything but an it, an undesirable it at that. Had all the Jews of Germany stood up and practiced satyagraha, I doubt seriously, Buber suggested, that the Germans would not have been stopped in their witless anger and violence one whit. They would not have been moved by any kind of example. They were not moved later on when they organized the camps, the death camps, where there were people who were as bold and as calm and as courageous and as nonviolent as Gandhi ever was. Nor is it true, unfortunately, that the passive resistance of peoples to violence commands attention across the world. How much has the death of millions in Cambodia commanded our attention? How much has the destruction of the Kurds in Iran and Iraq commanded the attention, the action of the West? Did the destruction of the Armenians in the early part of the century by the Turks lead to any kind of massive world outcry? The answer is no, and no, and no again. Nonviolence, active nonviolence, works under certain conditions. We saw one of those situations in our own country 20, 30 years ago during the Civil Rights Campaign when Martin Luther King reshaped Gandhi's doctrines to the American scene. And the conditions were relatively similar. Just as England had come to the point where India was no longer of great economic benefit, was more a cost to them than a benefit, so segregation in the United States had come to the point when it was costing us more than it was a benefit to those who were in privileged placement positions. It was a time of prosperity. It was a time where there seemed to be opportunities in the society for everyone. There was a society here of law, and clearly unjust laws could be changed by the legislature as well as by the courts. There was a great body of opinion who saw the injustice of all that had been done to the blacks, to other minorities. The time was ripe for change. And when the time is ripe for change, and when change can be lifted up, when consciousness can be raised by the nobility of certain kinds of nonviolent action, the silent march of in the South, the sitting in the front of the bus, then, in fact, nonviolent action is effective. It is seen, it is noticed, it becomes a catalyst to change, it moves ahead a change which probably would have taken place anyway, in any case. But when we come to the determined genocide of a people by those who have decided that that people is not worth the name humanity, and when we come to the efficient and impersonal butchery which modern war represents, then I'm afraid that however much I would like to be able to say to you that this kind of active nonviolence is an answer because I know of no other, I must honestly say that despite its nobility, it will not necessarily lead to the peace we all seek. There are many men and women of quality and of conviction and of courage who in our time have stood up for their values, their country, their freedom, justice. And most of them you've never heard of, and I've never heard of. They weren't picked up by the press. And some of those who burnt themselves as human torches for their cause were one day sensations, and then quickly forgotten. Gandhi was fortunate that he came into a society where the holy man was a known figure, one who had for centuries commanded great respect, at a time when the society was ripe for independence, for change, and certainly he shows us qualities of courage and nobility of spirit and of understanding and true understanding of his fellow human beings that we would all want to cultivate in ourselves. But when it comes to the problem with which we began, the missiles in their silos, the billions of dollars spent by every country on the face of the earth for what is euphemistically called national defense, but which really is simply armaments, the piling up of weapons which can kill. When it comes to that problem, a single man or even a legion of Gandhis will, I doubt, be able to resolve the problems that we face. We're going to have to face the problems of war and peace structurally. We'll have to find a way to create a force which is larger than, stronger and more just than that of the greed of any nation, which can impose its will, the will of the world, for peace upon the nations. And we're going to have to recognize that we're going to live under the shadow for a long, long time and pray as our people have always prayed. Sim shalom, tova v'racha, chein v'chesed v'rachamim aleinu v'al kol Yisrael. Grant us peace, thy most precious gift, O thou eternal source of peace. Amen.